The auction was interrupted in the middle of dry goods. Buckwheat flour, pea flour, an exorbitant lot of coconut flour.
"Holly would kill for that," Milo said, twitching their bidding card.
"Don't,"
Brooke warned him. They still had to pay for sugar, 50 pounds of it, at least, for the fall preserves. And anyway, their daughter's passion for exotic ingredients was only her latest mutiny.
"You already promised her a phone battery."
Milo shrugged amiably and lowered the card. The kids were alone at the farm, a few hours' ride away. They had wanted to come, of course. Holly especially, strained against their isolation, living hours outside town. But the four of them couldn't all ride. A hard-wrought blight had turned half of their last cranberry crop to dry, cotton-filled beads, forcing Brooke to sell 2 horses for cash. They were down to just her old mare, Star, whom Brooke and Milo had ridden together from home that morning, leaving at dawn and planning to stay overnight. Brooke couldn't remember the last time the two of them had been away from the farm together. It would have been when Milo's mother was still alive to watch the kids. But Holly was 13 now, old enough to be left in charge, and Sal, at 8, was no longer the thumb-sucking baby sister she had been. They would be fine for one night. Brooke and Milo's getaway, if a supply run to Buxton could be counted as such, had been enjoyable so far. People kept finding Milo in the auction crowd, friends, former students, people he'd known for years, gripping his arm and embracing him. Brooke knew the pleasure Milo took in his hometown, and she was happy for him, though she kept her own greetings brief. She had never stopped being a stranger here. On the platform at the front of the parking lot, the auctioneer, a lanky, freckled grandmother, palmed her megaphone, sending a rough, amplified crackle through the air. Someone was climbing the platform, Brooke saw. She took in the symbol on the man's open windbreaker. It was rare for a marshal to travel this far, 200 miles from the federal border and the city beyond. The marshal leaned in and spoke to the auctioneer. There was another crackle from the speakers.
"Pause for a warrant," the auctioneer announced briefly.
She handed her megaphone to the marshal and folded herself into a chair, sipping bottled water. The energy in the crowd shifted, damped by a current of unease. Buxton had come through secession gentler than most. It was farming country, logging country, and the fight had been distant. Still, they held no more esteem for federal authority than anyone did this side of the border. For a minute, the marshal looked out over the crowd without speaking. Just to make them uncomfortable, Brooke thought. Even now, 30 years since the rural territory seceded, 25 since their hard-won sovereign government dissolved, the feds still acted like they had power. That smug tightness around the mouth. Not just the man's windbreaker, but his t-shirt and ball cap both bore the crest of the federal government.
"Do they make undies too?"
someone called out, to a skim of laughter. The marshal sighed and lifted a paper, reading his text into the megaphone slowly, as if to children.
"Addressed to residents of the unincorporated village known historically as Buxton. A fugitive is believed to be in your area. Local households are warned this man may try to obtain a vehicle or horse. He is dangerous and possibly armed. He is wanted on numerous charges, including trafficking, assault, destruction of federal property, and the murder of a federal narcotics officer."
Conversation around Brooke and Milo began to resume. The feds had no jurisdiction in the ceded territories, but they claimed the right to prosecute offenses against themselves. Everyone in the parking lot knew this marshal wasn't here out of concern for local households. Federal property had been damaged and a federal officer killed.